Ah, the lazy days of summer that exist for some are waning, while the farmers and ranchers are keeping on, keeping on, doing what the seasons dictate. I'm Robin. Welcome. We're off to chat with a couple of Easterners for Cultivated Audio August 2023. John Fichtner from West Virginia knows the value of the wetlands and has got some pretty great insights into how they thrive, serving the land, the animals, and us. And Owen Wormser, his Western Massachusetts background has afforded a literal learning ground for regeneratively driven landscapes, offering lawns a magical transformation and meadows to flourish. So grab your earbuds and or shovel and let's dig in. John, after Ag College, you said you went by their system for about a year and then struck out on your own. Was there an aha moment to that, or just an obvious shift was needed?
Well, in a way, it's kind of an aha moment, but growing up on the farm and just observing things, it didn't seem right to me to begin with. But, you know, you get in that and you study it and you think, well, they know what they're talking about and this and that. But a couple of times I spread some systemic pesticide on the garden. It was just a dust. I got really sick when I did it, just the dust, the fumes off of the dust. You know, I got real nauseated and sick, and I thought, man, this ain't right. And that really was kind of a moment that was decided, nah, I ain't going to do this anymore.
Right. I'm really happy you were one of the pioneers here. Give us a basic description about the 80 acres you have that you farm and ranch in West Virginia, the geography, perhaps rainfall.
Okay. Actually, it's about 100 acres. Of this 100 acres, when I first came here, maybe about 30 of it was cleared for pasture and meadow, and a lot of it was even steep. The rainfall we get is probably maybe in the neighborhood of 40, 45 inches of rain. It's a humid environment, very humid. I came from the northeastern part of the state, and it was a big change coming down here. I'm in the southwestern part of the state now, along the Ohio River, and gets very humid. It's very hard on livestock, hard on people. It's just a tough situation to farm in.
Well, you taught forestry and conservation for many years. What was the main lesson for you cementing the importance of following nature's lead into working a regenerative system?
Okay. I felt it was important that the students have a good understanding. I always told the kids, I said, kids, school's all about rote memory. In other words, they teach you something, they tell you this, and then you give it back to them on the test, and that's the way they evaluate. I said, I'm not interested in that. I said, I want you to be critical thinkers. I want you to think about things and learn about it. As far as tests and things of that nature, we didn't do much of that. And we worked outside. It was hands-on. We taught them to appreciate nature. Sometimes we'd have scavenger hunts. They loved that. We'd have competitions, and they'd go out and look for things. We had a 50-acre woodlot there, and it was our nature area, and we had logging roads, so they learned to build the logging roads, how to maintain them to prevent erosion. And it was steep ground where we was at, real steep. And we built wetlands, and we put in native grasslands, and of course we had the forest there. So we had all these things on just 50 acres, so we had a real diversity of habitats there for different things. The kids seemed to appreciate get out there and look at things and learn about them. But I had high school juniors and seniors predominantly, and it was obvious they didn't learn the basics in biology. They didn't know the basics in math. They didn't know the basic things. So we did the stuff, and it was practical.
I like that. When one of my grandchildren was growing up, I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to help teach her math. So we would make recipes that we would make 1.5 of, and so she'd have to figure out how to do that. I think that's a great way and practical way to learn. Obviously, you taught them observation skills. I also love that you call your farm a wildlife sanctuary, and you've taken great care where water is concerned. Share some of what you've discovered about the importance of the wetlands.
Okay. I had the good fortune that during the time I was teaching there, I got interested in the wetlands, and I ran across a book by Tom Biebighauser, who was a specialist in developing wetlands for North America. And he actually came to our school and did workshops like 3 or 4 days, and there was people that came there from as far away as Kansas. So I learned a lot about building wetlands, how they operate, how they function, things that I didn't know before, I never had heard of before. And he's written a couple really good books, too. And one's more on the history and about the wetlands, another one's on how to make them. I was real fortunate there. And so we built several. We had like 12 different little wetlands there on the place. I always tell people, when you build a wetland like that, and a lot of them was on tops of hills, because we have a lot of red clay. Don't even have to have much runoff into it. It holds the water year-round. But when you build a wetland like that, you get all kinds of wildlife there that never existed there before. Mm. You're going to have frogs. You're going to have dragonflies. You're going to have all types of wetland plants, rushes and sedges and things. Everything's different just by doing that. So I think you go on top of a hill, it's dry, there's nothing there, and then all of a sudden you've got all this different stuff going on for the wildlife just by adding that. And it waters the wildlife. And then we would put in plants. We would incorporate native plants that weren't there in the area, but possibly and probably had been there in the past. And we felt that was very important to use the native plants. And one of the things I like about native plants is the fact that if you get them established and they start growing, then you can put the seed out, so they'll get acclimated to your area, and then they start spreading on their own.
So in the wetlands, are you talking about making ponds?
That's small ponds, and some of them are what we call vernal ponds. In other words, they would dry up during the summertime, and people think, well, that's no good. You can't have fish in it. Well, that's the whole point, because when you have ponds year-round, certain predators like the fish eat up the frog eggs and certain salamander eggs. So by having those intermittent ponds or vernal ponds, they would have water in them long enough for the salamanders and frogs to lay their eggs and to get mature enough they could leave the ponds. And then after that, there wasn't these predators in there, because some of these predators require a couple years, like your bullfrogs and your green frogs have to have 2-year life cycle. And they're the ones that eat up the little spring peepers and the mountain chorus frogs and other smaller frogs.
Now, what are some of the first steps in creating a pond, and how do you decide where it will go?
Well, kind of, you just look around aesthetically where you would like one. That's part of it. And then part of it is, will the soil hold the water? I mean, you can do some soil samples and you can do some checking. And then another thing that I learned from him was very valuable. When you have a wetland or like a small pond, normally, I'd always thought, and most people do, you do the overflow and you kind of run it into a gully. And he said, no, you want to run it out on about a 1% or 2% grade out along the hill. And that makes sense once you figure it out, because that allows the water to soak into the soil and it recharges your aquifers, your groundwater, mm-hmm. your wells. It just doesn't run into the gully. And also it helps prevent flooding, and it's like a sponge. It collects any toxins the wetlands do. Of course, along that ditch, that water causes everything to be greener. The grass and everything along that ditch, it's kind of like swales. It just really improves the soil by having that extra water there.
Now, do you think the indigenous plants to the area, when you talk about the toxins coming into the water, do you think the native plants are remediating those toxins?
Yes. That's one thing about wetlands. They do suck up toxins. A lot of people think of wetlands, they think of mosquitoes. Well, where you have a healthy wetland, you don't have mosquitoes. Mm. They just don't exist because of the dragonflies and all the other predators there. It's where you have unhealthy ones where they've dumped chemicals and things of that nature. So a healthy system is very important.
Yeah, this is totally an aside, but I followed the work of Gaston Nassens, and he made this anti-cancer remedy, and he was able to cure so many people from their cancer by having them inject a camphor-based medicine into their lymph system down by their groin. And somebody died, and she was, you know, she literally died the day after she went to see him, but her family was very upset, so they brought him to court for practicing medicine without a license and for actually murder. And this was a big case in Canada many years ago. And people literally came around the world on his behalf because he had helped them get over cancer. And he likened the mosquitoes to cancer cells. He said, "My medicine is not anti-cancer, but it cleans up the environment of the body." And so you're talking about the same thing here in the pond, and it's all great.
Exactly. For instance, dragonflies, a lot of people don't realize that the early stages of their life, they live in the water. The dragonfly larvae or the nymphs, they live about 2 years in the water. And during that time, they eat mosquito larvae. And then when they come out of the water, a lot of times they only may live 6 weeks. When they're in the air, they're eating the flying mosquitoes.
Yeah. Conservation also fits in with working with the streams and slowing the flow. What can you tell us about that piece, helping to slow the flow, or what is the process to help a stream flow slower during a time of heavy rains?
Okay, that's very important, and that's a good question, because a lot of people I see, this goes on all the time, people want to clear the trees off of the banks, they want to straighten the creeks out, they want to dig them deeper, and all these things because they're worried about flooding. Well, people don't realize, when you look at a stream, now, I don't know what it's like out in Colorado, but I know here in West Virginia, we've got so many streams that you have the ground level, and then it drops down maybe 1 or 2 feet to where the water level is. And some places it might be 5 and 6 feet it drops down to where the water level. People do not understand that that water level is supposed to be even with the ground level. That's the floodplain. That's where it's supposed to be connected. It should not be below the ground level. People don't understand that, and they cut the trees off, and they straighten it out. All these things speed the water up, cause more erosion. Naturally, a stream's supposed to meander. It's supposed to meander. It's supposed to have a lot of vegetation on it. That's your riparian area, and that's an important wildlife area. Some of the things that we did in some of the areas was we built what was called beaver analog dams. And you would go across a small area, and sometimes they were intermittent streams were. In other words, the streams weren't there all the time, but when they it was flooding, they did come in there. And we would drive stakes in the ground, and then we would cut branches off of trees, long, thin branches, and then weave them in those stakes like you would a basket. Mm. And that's one of the beaver analog dams. You could throw leaves in behind it, and you could throw any kind of organic matter. It becomes like a catchment. And it's not stopping the water. It's slowing the water down just like the beaver dams did. That's one way to slow it down. And it's not hard to do. It's not expensive. Another way is to find a place and dig into the bank on both sides of the stream and drop a log down in it. The slot that you made on each side of the stream will hold that log. And you do it so that the water still runs over. You're not trying to stop the water. You're just slowing it down. Mm. And then over a period of time, that log will catch all the rock and silt and stuff behind it, and it will fill up and bring the level of the bottom of the stream up. This is what we need to do, is bring the bottom of the stream up, because most of the time it's already gone to the bedrock. In other words, it's gone as far as it can go. It's gone to bedrock, and that's it. So you have to reverse that and start bringing the stream up, and that's how you bring the water level up to the ground level. People don't realize that when the water level's at the ground level, you don't have problem with droughts and things, because that water is sucked back into the ground just like a tissue laid on a wet spot. It sucks it back into the ground, and the roots can reach it. When the roots are 6 feet away from it, because your stream's cut into the ground, they can't reach it. So then you get the dry spots. And we call those incised streams because they're cut into the ground. And that's what we have lots of. And it's just by bad management. And people think they're doing the right thing. And, you know, it's just a matter of education. And a lot of people will think it's crazy, the things I've just said about that. But look at nature and look how the beavers did. Real good book called Eager by Ben Goldfarb. It's on beavers and the dams and the importance they had in this country. And one of the things they mentioned there is a lot of our streams weren't streams like we think they are. They were just a series of ponds. Mm. And that's the way they were. They weren't like what we think they were.
Yeah, that's an amazing amount of great information there. Thank you so much, John. And conservation would not be complete without animals. And I know you keep sheep, donkeys, and cattle. How do you work the grazing, having all three?
Of course, the animals and the people that follow Alan Savory know that the animals are considered a tool to heal the land, and they definitely are. I move the animals. I have a plan, and I have a plan grazing, and they're getting moved different times, different places, break it up so it's not always the same place, same time of year. I have them graze it pretty close usually, and then I move on. And when I graze it close, that gives all the plants an equal chance to come up, and I get a lot more diversity. I've seen a big improvement in diversity, and I've seen a big improvement in the quantity of feed and the quality of the feed by doing this. For the most part, I move the sheep in one group when I have donkeys in with them some. The reason I don't have cattle in with them is because I use this electric netting, and if I had the cattle in there, it'd be twice as much netting that I would have to move. I move the cattle with a single strand of electric, and they're a lot of times covering the same area, but maybe they're rotating. Maybe this grazing the sheep will go through, and the next grazing the cattle will go through and break it up, and they do different things. Ideally, it would be nice to have them all together, but the way I'm set up, I have basically no permanent fence. It's all this portable electric fence. But I think it would be good to put them all together at once. But this is working out good. And the donkeys, some of them will run with the cattle because they'll stay in one strand. And some of them run with the sheep to help keep predators away. I think they do a good job with that.
So donkeys can be there instead of dogs?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Cool.
The donkeys are excellent protection animals. And you don't have to take dog feed out to them either. They just eat
right.
What the sheep eat.
That's great.
Yeah, they are excellent, and I like them. And like I said, you don't have to take dog feed them. And I have border collies I work my sheep with. As I move the fence, I have the border collies hold the sheep in the corner, and then I move the fence and then let them go. And then I move the back fence. I don't move the back fence as often as I move the front fence. Every day I'll move the front fence and give them new grass, sometimes even twice a day. It depends on how much rainfall we've had and how fast things are growing. And that kind of determines how fast I move the back fence.
Of course.
Also, sometimes I leave a pathway because I don't have water systems all over the place. I will leave a pathway back to the water, and then sometimes I leave a pathway back for shade because some areas there's not shades. Sometimes they're traveling over certain areas for longer periods of time.
And John, in an earlier conversation, you mentioned you're on a mission to have parasite-resistant, if not free, sheep. And is the best medicine putting them in the field?
Diversity of their feed is a big thing to help them out. There's a lot of things you can use that are natural. I do cut some things like wormwood. I raise it and throw it into the field sometimes. And walnut, the leaves, I throw them in, and other types of trees. But selecting for parasite resistance, it's a challenge. And I think it's important because when we're using these anthelmintics, anti-wormers, that we're also going to probably be killing the dung beetles and maybe hurting the earthworms and hurting a lot of the microorganisms in the soil. So that's kind of my driving force to have parasite-resistant animals. Unfortunately, I haven't reached that point yet, but I'm getting closer all the time. And I save my ram lambs out of my very best ewes. I have some ewes that show a lot of resistance, and I will save ram lambs out of them and use them. I'm not able to go out and buy rams other places that'll even begin to be as parasite resistant as what I'm raising. And I think it's important that people raise stock ought to consider that, because what they raise on their own place is probably going to be their best sires. They'd rather it be cattle or sheep, because they take their best female and take the best son out of them. That son's going to be half of the herd genetically, and why not use your own genetics to improve it?
Yes, absolutely. And I've read that the innate resistance is lower during lambing and during lactation periods. So are the female sheep, the ewes, more susceptible to having a parasite problem than the rams?
Well, like I say, that's one reason to save out of the ewes that are showing the good resistance. But, yeah, anytime there's stress, it wouldn't matter if it was lambing or whether it's just a bad period of heat. There was a time here a couple years ago that we had about two or three days in a row where the heat index was up to like 113. So that's hard on animals.
Whoa.
And some animals can take it and some can't.
Yeah, I'd be one of those animals that would be running down your path to the shade for sure.
Yeah.
Is there a breed you recommend to at least get off to a good start? And are there any breeds disappearing because of this problem?
What I'm using in my situation is a Scottish Blackface and the Cheviots. I've been using them because those are hill country sheep, and they have been selected for toughness and hardiness. Normally, they're pretty good mothers and take good care of their young, because I lamb on pasture. The animals don't get in the barn. They stay out year-round. They will lamb on pasture about middle March through April, the sheep do, and I don't go out and check them all the time either. I might check them in the early morning, and throughout the day I'll look at them occasionally, and then late at night before I go in, and then I don't get up at night and check them. They have to do it on their own, and if they can't, then they just have to leave. So those two breeds, and then recently I've added a ram. It's called the Wiltshire Horn, and they're a breed that shed their wool. They have a short wool. They're a British breed, and they shed their wool. And the reason I'm adding that to the Cheviots, I'm wanting to breed the wool off of the Cheviots, since I've already got pretty good parasite resistance. I just want to take the wool off them, because the wool's just not a sale for it, at least the coarser medium-grade wool, so there's no market for it. We can't even sell it.
Do you sell some wool? Do you have some of the longer, less coarse wool that you sell? Or what do you use the sheep for?
Okay, sheep primarily sell them as meat animals and some for breeding stock. And that's kind of the main thing. And then some people get them just to clean up the land because they are tough and hardy. As in place of goats, some people think about goats. Well, these will eat about anything goats will eat, plus more. They're better grazers, and they seem to have a lot more worm resistant than goats. Goats are more browsers, and as a rule, don't have as good a parasite resistant as the sheep do.
And what would you be looking at physically in the sheep to see if they're starting to have a parasitic problem?
Okay, well, there's about three things you can look at pretty close. All their jaw will get kind of swelled up, and they call that bottle jaw. That's a sign of worms, parasites. Another one is people roll their eyelid down and look at it and see how the color of it is. If it's a kind of a dark reddish color, it's good. They're good shape. And if it's real white, they're anemic. And if it's real white, they're in pretty bad shape. That's a sign. And then another thing is just a lot of manure, like a diarrhea-type manure around their hind end. These are some things. And then just general unthriftiness.
General unthriftiness? What do you mean?
Well, like they're not putting the weight on like they should. In other words, they're thin. Well, their eyes might not look alert, and they might have a snotty nose and things like that. They just don't look like they feel good.
And so then do you separate them out?
No, I will just usually treat those. I don't normally treat the adult sheep for parasites, because I do the lambs, but not the adults, because hopefully by that time they've developed a resistance.
Right. And, John, what's one thing you'd share to the novice farmer rancher to clear their path a little bit?
Keep your expenses low. I have very little overhead. My main thing I have on this farm, basically, is just a side-by-side and my border collies. That's it. I have an old farm tractor that I use to move round bales around with, and I pull manure spreader occasionally with it. But it's just an old two-wheel drive farm tractor. And other than that, I don't have much machinery. People get the idea as soon as they're on a farm, they got to buy tractors and they got to buy haymaking equipment, and they get really in debt now. And I see this also, a lot of people are doing it as tax write-offs. That's the reason they do it. It's just a tax write-off. They're not trying to necessarily make money. They know it's not making them money, but people buy a lot of equipment, and they buy everything they see.
Right.
a neighbor here, and every little thing he saw, he was buying. He got some sheep from me, and he had to buy, there's something you put on the udder to milk it. It's like a handheld thing, and all these different things he had. I've had sheep since the early 80s, and I never had all these things.
Well, John, now to share a little known fact about you. You've held your breath for 8 minutes. So considering Tom Cruise's personal best is about 6.5 minutes, you could be a candidate for the next Mission Impossible movie with that record.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, I follow Wim Hof. I like what Wim Hof has to say. I think he's a good guy to listen to.
Yeah, what do you feel is a benefit from doing that type of work for you personally?
Well, I just think it helps your circulation. I think people need to get all the oxygen they can in their lungs. I think that was one of the real problems they had when people wearing masks. They don't realize we don't get enough oxygen as it is, and you put a mask on, you're even getting less. So
right.
You need to get that oxygen.
Yes.
That keeps you healthy. Get that oxygen in your blood and breathe deep. I shear sheep. I still shear my own sheep. I use the hand shears to shear them like the old timers just did. And I think about it. I used to not pay attention to my breathing when I was working. Now I pay a lot more attention to that and certain things like unloading feed and stuff and things that require more strength. And I know that the deep breathing helps.
Right. And another piece of Wim Hof's work and of many healers is using cold showers. How does that affect your world?
Well, I've been doing that for a couple of years, too. And I used to have a heart condition, probably still do, like AFib, but it doesn't really affect me. I don't take any medications whatsoever. I think it really helps get you stimulated. I take it in the morning, take a cold shower, and I don't like it. I don't look forward to it even yet. I've been doing it for about 2.5 years, but I don't want to go without doing it because it seems to take the soreness away. I don't have soreness, and it gives me a lot more energy. When I was home all day when I was working, like on Saturdays or something, I'd feel groggy and want to take a nap in the afternoon. Now I don't ever take naps. I'm here all the time, and I don't take naps, don't feel like I need them.
John, this is so great. Thank you. You're so chock full of great, usable, and common sense information. And I loved how your initial statement about building a pond, part of it is aesthetic and that value. And it really related in my mind to the meandering of streams and how they're supposed to meander. And so I'm taking that personally. And I think I can benefit from a little more meandering and really helps in and noticing more and slowing down too.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I hope people will start looking at some of those things because, you know, we just don't take care of the land. And what we are is stewards of the land. People think they own the land and can do anything they want because it's their land, but all we are stewards. We're just here to take care of it.
Yeah, well, thank you for creating a nice wildlife sanctuary. Owen, in consulting, designing, and installing landscapes, you cultivate holistic qualities that are both sustainable and ecological, and I bet they are also aesthetically pleasing without even trying.
There's a focus on aesthetics, so there is an underpinning that involves some effort there, because aesthetics are terribly important. For most people who aren't already sold on meadows, the only thing they care about is the aesthetics. So that's something that I usually am able to make work with meadows by using species that are similar heights so that one species doesn't block out or overshadow other species, which eventually will lead to the shorter species being pushed out of most meadows. But it also just allows you to see everything there. And I try to spread out flowering times over the course of the season as well to provide that aesthetic interest. But of course, having flowers out throughout the course of the season provides food and pollen for pollinators. And in general, these two areas of focus of creating sustainable habitat and beauty are something that can be woven together really easily because there's so many plants to choose from. It's really only kind of a more traditional Western approach to gardening and the landscape that precludes this notion that you have to give up one for the other. And so sustainability can be beautiful.
Yes. And as an advocate for creating meadows over lawns and author of Lawns to Meadows, do you see these projects more for towns taking on or individual homes?
Both is appropriate and hopefully is happening. Anywhere there's available space, and in most cases that applies to lawns in private settings and public settings, because very little lawn actually gets used, never gets walked on. It just gets mowed and treated with fertilizers and chemicals. So those are the spaces that are really good candidates for transforming lawn into meadow. ultimately, it can happen anywhere where there's full sun and available space.
In thinking about it, the ecological reasons for having a biodiverse meadow are just becoming clearer and clearer the more we look into that, obviously. And yet, my mind went to, oh, but the kids play ball on the lawns. And so, yes, that's a factor, but for someone who does want to have a cleared area for their barbecues or their children to play ball, there's four corners, right? And there are ways to weave the meadow environment into a yard. And it's so worthwhile, I would imagine. I mean, even if you're doing a lawn that is chemical free, to have a corner here or there or somewhere off to the side, that diversity would just enhance the entire yard or area, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And there are areas that are used for play, recreation, walking, that are mowed turf. And those are really important areas. We don't need to give those up. Like you mentioned, the corners of yards and spaces like that, they're good areas to allow to become habitat and also be more beautiful, because grass is a monoculture and ultimately doesn't offer any color or variety.
Yes, and when we start doing a project, say someone wanted to start adding this biodiversity into their property, or even I could see groups getting together and doing this in their town, I would imagine that patience is definitely a part of the process, especially in the beginning. But what do you learn from observing what is growing already? What kind of a lesson is there for us?
Yeah, patience is a really big part of this, especially when planting perennial wildflower seeds. That's something that I have to tell my clients all the time. It's very important and can't be underscored enough, because a lot of times perennial seeds take 2 or 3 years to really start to show up. And sometimes certain species will take as many as 4 or 5 or even 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
So we're dealing with plants and how they behave, and the existing plants that are on site offer clues to what wants to be there. Even if they're weeds or plants that are undesirable in our eyes, those plants can give us information about what the soil's like, what the hydrology's like, how much sunlight it's getting. All of those factors are what you want to take into account to choose the species that you plant on that site so that they thrive, because really the plants are going to be successful if they like the conditions. So you really need to match what you choose to the site conditions. The more you can read the site, the better, and looking at the plant species that are there will offer you a lot of clues.
Can you give an example of something you've noticed? Okay, this field has a lot of X. Can you share what X is and what clues it gave you?
So a lot of times lawns in the Northeast, where I live in Western Massachusetts, there will be lawns that have been mowed for a while and they're on poor soil in that it's not rich in organic matter. And a lot of times it's kind of sandy, very well drained, and the grass doesn't grow very well there because people aren't fertilizing it, or even if they are fertilizing and irrigating, the soil is just so weak and everything just filters through it, so the grass never grows. So that in itself is a clue. But then in lieu of that, there's open space between the grass that's growing there. And a lot of times, these really little plants like Antenaria, which is known as pussy toes, or bluettes, I think it's Housatonia, these little plants will grow in these spaces. And whenever those plants show up, they're indicators of that type of soil. So they're only able to grow in that location when nothing else really wants to grow there, because they're so diminutive that they can't compete with anything taller. So that's an example of some species that if I see them in a lawn, it means that that type of soil is present, sandy, low in organic matter, really well-drained soil.
So when you are starting off on a project, you mentioned that some of the wildflowers, for instance, or the perennials might take up to 5 or 6 years. And I think that probably is unusual, but I don't know, to take that much time. Is that because of the particular plant or because of how healthy the soil is?
Probably more the plant species.
I see.
Most of the plants that I'm using in perennial meadows are going to show up in 2 to 3 years, like something like Monarda fistulosa, bergamot. Mm-hmm. That is a plant that often will show up in the first year or two, as does something like lanceleaf coreopsis. And so some of those species are really, really important. But I've had the experience where I put down something called Turk's cap lily, which is a native lily to the northern U.S. and northeast. And it's a true lily. This lily was planted from seed along with a bunch of other plants that would do well in a woodland clearing. So it wasn't a true meadow because it didn't get enough sun, but it was very meadow-like. And a lot of these species were well-suited for it and established. And after 5 or 6 years, I just gave up on the Turk's cap lily even being there. And after 7 years, my client sent me a picture and it was of dozens of these plants in full bloom. And so I think that is unusual that some species take that long, but seed's pretty mysterious stuff, and it seems to be selective in some way. Like if seeds don't like, quote unquote, like an area where they're on the ground, they won't sprout. And if they do, they will. So there's some sort of process going on that's poorly understood by science that determines what happens. There's already usually an existing seed bank, and plants know when to sprout.
Now, as you mentioned, you are in the Northeast in the USA, but meadows not only have universal benefits, but I'm sure there are universal procedures. And I'm wondering if you could mention another one or two that could help someone get inspired to undertake a project like this.
Really, a meadow is a space that is absent of woody plants, trees and shrubs, that has a significant amount of grasses and then these meadow forbs, these meadow flowering species. The way that that historically has happened is through fire and grazing. That's really what enhanced these meadows to exist. In our case, it's mostly in modern times comes down to mowing or selectively editing out plants that you don't want. So there's no one right way to create a meadow, because ultimately you're trying to get certain types of species that can grow in these grasslands with the grasses and can flower to grow there. And you're at the same time trying to discourage the plants that you don't want to grow. So you can start by tilling and removing everything, or you could just start by selectively weeding and cutting back what you don't want and sprinkling seed down into the same area and hoping that some of the species that you're putting down by seed will establish over time. So really the game is, in the long run, to edit out what you don't want and encourage what you want. And there's a lot of ways that you can go about that. So ultimately doing that is what's going to get you results in the long run.
What do you experience as the most unknown benefit to creating meadows?
You know, researching my book, it was interesting to learn how effective grasslands are in general at sequestering carbon. There's a lot of carbon that gets put in the ground from established meadow, prairie, savanna, all of these types of grasslands. And being able to do that in your own yard, it actually can add up over time if more people did this. Because at the same time, by transitioning from having lawn to something that is an actual carbon sink, you're really going from one end of the ecological spectrum with lawn, which is putting carbon in the atmosphere and is generally environmentally destructive in terms of the runoff from fertilizers and impact of chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. Really, that was the ecological benefit of meadows is many layered, and that aspect of how they help with sequestering carbon was something that I found really interesting and didn't know about previously.
And what was the most difficult piece in writing your book? What did you find the most difficult piece to actually relay through the written word?
I think when I mentioned the importance of patience, that touched upon it a little bit. But ultimately, the linchpin to building a meadow and really creating any sort of landscape with ecological value is collaborating with nature and collaborating with plants. And so this is kind of an alien concept to most people in our Western culture, because we're not taught it. We're not exposed to that. In most cases, it's pretty rare. And that's something that is central to creating a meadow, because you're really trusting that by putting the right plant in the right place, you can get the results that you're hoping for. And really, you're collaborating with nature. You're doing the setup, but those plants are doing the work. And so that ability to trust that we don't have to do everything, we don't have to manage everything, we can trust the innate intelligence of these plants, give them what they want by putting them in the right place, and then they'll take it from there. And so I think that understanding is something that I tried really hard to share in the book, and it's important to underscore because it is generally something that's a new concept for most people.
Yes, and I think any good farmer or rancher really does have a keen eye of observation every morning, or they get up and they look at their land or at their animals, and it's the keen eye that is such a great tool.
Absolutely. That's really the linchpin of it all. And every indigenous culture around the planet is built around observation of nature and working with it and not making assumptions that we know, because there's always more to learn. And what we do know is when it's coming from nature is something that is direct knowledge. It's not partitioned through science or broken down into its pieces.
Right.
We're able to gather this sort of bigger picture from actually observing directly. And that's something that each of us can go out and do at any point in time.
Yes, that's definitely true. And I loved when you were talking about the project that you did at Eric Carle's Museum for Children's Art that he made for his wife. You know, you said seats hardly filled a half of a 5-gallon bucket, and you transformed this entire acre. And I just love the visual of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's this reality that nature wants to be abundant. And I think we have undercut the abundance of nature as a sort of modern humanity, because we've eaten up all of this land for cars, for buildings, for agriculture, all of these things. Much of it has been necessary in terms of advancing the civilization that we're part of. But at the same time, it's not taking into account that what's already there wants to be abundant. And so we're creating all of these systems and all of these things to create food or whatever it is. And ultimately, we could be in a situation that's much more collaborative, where we have the best of both worlds, and we're actually able to simply encourage nature and still give ourselves space for what we need, like growing food and having transportation. So instead, we just treat it as a resource, and we've degraded it enormously to the point that we think that's its natural state. And that's really what I'm driving at here with this point, is that it's not. Nature wants to be abundant. And so by planting a meadow, by putting seed in the ground, by engaging in that way, you have an opportunity to learn firsthand that nature wants to be abundant, and you can see it unfold in front of your own eyes, which is a lot of fun and really encouraging.
Yes, and has so many lessons, and every visual just feeds into so many directions into our lives, and not to mention the butterflies and birds, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's just another piece of getting the city folk involved, where the farmers and ranchers are out doing their thing, but this is such a beautiful piece to start thinking meadows.
Because I always encourage people who don't have space or a lot of space or any space that they can put out a window box or a planter and plant a couple pollinator plants, and you'll be surprised by what shows up, because that's the nature of what we've been discussing, that these plants become like magnets. If you build it, they will come. That's even true in cities.
so great that these folks get to share what they know with us. John Fichtner and Owen Wormser, thank you so much. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.